Peter Hernis. I'm a faculty member at University of California in Davis, and my research area is river biogeochemistry, but I teach a class on water quality to undergraduates. It's in the Science and Society program, and so the idea is to teach teach them in scientific literacy, environmental literacy, just because there's so many environmental issues that are coming to the fore right now. We're going to have to vote on them more and more frequently, and so it's kind of important for it to have everybody as educated as possible on environmental issues so that they can make reasonable choices when they go to the ballot box. One of the things I like about teaching a course like that is I can sort of indulge myself, and anything that I'm kind of interested in learning myself, I'll put it on the syllabus, and then it forces me to go and learn. And so it's a little bit of a playground to do it. And this falls a little bit into that category. So I don't do mine water quality out of mines. I don't do research on mine drainage, anything like that. This is sort of, I guess it'd have to be classified more as a hobby than as a research interest here too. And so what I've done here today is to put together a set of slides, and maybe we'll go back and forth a little bit between the board and the projector here. As we go along, we'll see how this thing goes. But, you know, really I want this to be not just a complete indulgence of mine. I want it to be geared toward what you're interested in as well. And so I kind of put this together because I wanted to know more about the Holden mine and more about the water quality stuff, because, you know, clearly it's these issues have been lurking for a long time. You know, the tailings are obvious. You come up to the mine, you can't help but notice that there's a problem, that there's potential for environmental problems with all the tailings around there. If you walk up anywhere around the mine site there, you can see the color of the water that's coming out. You can see white precipitate all over the rocks. If you look in Railroad Creek, you can see orange precipitate on the rocks. So, you know, it's obvious to your eye that there is a problem here. It's been festering for a long, long time. I first came up here in 1976 with my family. They brought me up as an 11-year-old. My daughter right now, my youngest daughter, is 11 years old. And so but it's all coming to the fore right now. After all these years, after all the talk, all the meetings, all the studies, all the sessions, it's finally here. They're actually going to start doing something about it. And, you know, even the fact that they're doing something about it is a little bit controversial as well. So I decided that I come up here, I want to do one session on mine stuff, and I want to dig into the water quality issues related to this mine here and just kind of see for myself, study for myself firsthand what the issues are. So we're going to talk a little bit about just mine legacy in general and the problems with mines. I have a bunch of slides here that I've picked out of one of the latest reports that was put together by the Washington Department of Ecology. From 1996, they came through here and they did a series of studies, a series of measurements and tests on the water above the mine, from Railroad Creek above the mine, from the mine portal, from leachate that's coming off the tailings, from Railroad Creek just below the tailings, and some, I think they did a sampling site at near 7 Mile Creek, and then down by the mouth leading into Chelan. And so I just pulled a bunch of tables and figures out of that report here, and I'll just kind of walk through some of the things that I found the most interesting here too. And if it gets too boring, let me know, and we'll speed past those on to something else, like, you know, snack bar or something like that. But anyway, so this is sort of my indulgence, but I hope you guys find it a little bit interesting too here, so that you have a little bit more background on what exactly, why we're going to be shutting this place down virtually for a couple of years. So water pollution, the legacy of mining. Well, there's several mining issues here. First of all, what does legacy refer to? This is kind of an outline of what I'm going to hit today, or what we're going to maybe try to take a look at. So what does legacy refer to? That's one of the questions we need to go after. What is acid mine drainage? So that's a common thing that you hear about in any when it comes to mines. What kind of contaminants are released? What are the impacts of this contamination as it's released into the water? A look at specifically at the Holden mine issues here, again, pulling this data out of these reports. Depending on how we're doing on time, I might jump over to some mercury mining issues in California. And then I have a kind of an interesting stand on reclamation in North Dakota, which it's not so directly related to water quality per se, but it's kind of I grew up in North Dakota, so that's my bias. Let me say that right up front there. But we had a governor in North Dakota in the late 60s, early 70s, named Art Link. Art Link's grandson Brian was my best friend going all the way through school. And he took a very unusual stand on coal mining when they came into there with the strip mining. You know, there was a lot of coal companies that wanted to come in there and just use strip mining and extract the coal and get out of town. And he took an interesting stance. So we'll take a look at one of his statements that he made relative to the whole mining issue and what he felt like was the proper way to deal with mines and these potential legacy issues. So, legacy. Anything that spans from one generation to the next. That's a legacy issue. I think I've kind of been drawn a little bit to them because I kind of like the idea of being able to clean up your own mess. You know, if you mess something up in your lifetime, you fix it in your lifetime. That's sort of my mentality. Legacy issues are things that are created in my lifetime that won't get cleaned up in my lifetime. It'll take my kids or it'll take my grandkids or my great-grandkids or great-great-grandkids to fix it and clean it up. In the same way, I've inherited some legacy issues for my great-great-grandparents as well. And so I'm just curious if you have any ideas of some of these legacy environmental issues that you would list. Let's do just a little bit of brainstorming here on some of the legacy issues that you're aware of, environmental.
Climate change.
Yeah, so climate change is definitely one. It's going to take, you know, a millennia or so for the carbon dioxide levels to decrease, and even then they won't decrease all the way down to where they are right now. So climate change is definitely climate. I know what I was thinking, but it's not what I wrote, is it? I've been experiencing that more and more lately here. I've discovered that absent-minded professors are created, not made. Some other legacy issues that you can think of in any kind of environmental thing? Yeah.
Perhaps the dam's effect on fisheries.
Okay.
Water pollution.
So you're thinking like anadromous fish, salmon spawning fish that they, you know, put in a dam and they can't get back to their spawning grounds.
And the heating of the pools.
Uh-huh.
The lakes.
Blocking the fish runs. Temperature. So water pollution. Any specific examples?
Well, I'm thinking about the leaching into the aquifers, pollutants. Several towns and cities in Minnesota now, you do not drink the water.
Mm-hmm. So what kind of contaminants are you thinking about?
I'm not sure what they are.
Okay.
Well, the agriculture, what's gone in from the fertilizers and the
nutrients
control,
is a big one, particularly nitrate.
And that goes into the rivers, of course.
Yeah, I mean, that's a big problem in California right now. They're finding all these elevated levels of nitrate in well water now, and this is water that's 50, 100, 200 years old, and they're finding it now. That means the worst is probably still coming, so that's definitely a legacy issue. Even if you clean up agriculture right now, you still have a couple hundred years of flushing before you could ever expect those levels to start dropping down in your wells. Any other kind of legacy issues that you can think of?
Hanford Nuclear Reservation.
Hanford, okay.
Nuclear plant.
Hanford, so nuclear, I don't know.
Waste.
So we'll put down nuclear waste. Other kinds of legacy issues?
Overfishing, oceans.
Overfishing. Others?
Any sort of species extinction?
Yeah, I guess that's a legacy thing, because they're not coming back.
I think about it.
Yeah, they're not coming back, that's for sure. Yeah, and you know, one of the themes that I've wanted to kind of hit on for this week is the issue of time. So legacy certainly covers that aspect of time here, that you know, we create a mess and we can't fix it up in our generation, that it takes a long, long time. Our view of time is pretty skewed in a lot of different ways. I mean, how many of you know that we're going through one of, if not the greatest extinction event in the history of the Earth right now? Bigger than the extinction event with the dinosaurs, when the dinosaurs were wiped out, or any of the extinction events, the rate at which species are going extinct right now is faster than anything that's happened before. We're not really in tune to that, because you know, our lifetimes are very, very short on the scale of geological events. I mean, it's hard for me to comprehend 1,000 years, let alone 100,000 years, or 1,000,000 years, or 1,000,000,000 years. And so these extinction events in the past tend to go over thousands, hundreds of thousands, a million years. That's how long it takes for some of these extinction events in the past to happen. We're doing that stuff in decades, hundreds of years right now. And because of because we have such a hard time relating to geological time scales here, we're not really truly aware of what our impact is on the planet right now, and how we relate. And that's sort of one of the things that I think, you know, we're definitely going to need to do, is to learn how to get in sync with the planet a little bit more, and not be so human-centric or anthropocentric on our attitudes towards environmental issues. We need to be able to relate more to the time scales that are important in the environment on geological time scales than just ours. So that's kind of the one of the ways that these legacy issues are important here, is that we have to expand our concept of time for legacies. Acid mine drainage. Let's see if I can keep stepping on cords here. And that can't be good. My daughter is up in the balcony, just because you thought you'd like to know that. So acid mine drainage. Anybody here have a good idea about where acid mine and drainage comes from, how it works, what it is? It's sulfuric acid. That's one of them. Okay, I'm going to try to give you as best I can a little chemistry exam or chemistry test here. Sorry, chemistry example. Chemistry lecture, that's what I'm trying to say. So, in a lot of ways, acid mine drainage comes from, it's sort of the same principle of breathing. I mean, when we breathe, we're taking in oxygen, and our body uses that oxygen, and I'm just going to put sort of a generic form. This is carbohydrate, sugar. Our body takes oxygen and adds it to this carbohydrate, this organic matter. And in the process, a lot of energy is released. That's why we do it. That's the whole purpose of breathing and eating here, is, you know, we combine the oxygen and the carbohydrate. We get a lot of energy that's released. And we also release carbon dioxide, and we release water. And this is how it's represented in pretty much any kind of a biology textbook. But the fact of the matter is that these two things, before they ever get out of your blood, are actually combined together into something that looks like this. Any of you have enough chemistry background to know what that product is, what that compound is? Alec? This one here is carbonic acid. And that's exactly what you have in any kind of soda. When you drink a can of Coke, I've heard that, you know, you take a can of Coke and you can stick a tooth in there and apparently it dissolves over just a few days. That's what I've been told. I haven't tried it myself. But that's carbonic acid. That's the carbon dioxide that makes carbonated beverages. So this is something that you get in any kind of soda, any kind of carbonated beverage. But the point here is that when you combine oxygen with this carbohydrate, you form an acid. And much the same thing is happening in a mine. A mine, when it's all sealed up, when the rock is solid and there's no oxygen in there, there's very little chemistry that's happening. But when you open it up, like they did with the hole in mine here, when you open that mine up, there's sort of my mountain, I guess, and you start to put in all these little pathways and things in there. And I don't know, I'm not a miner, so this is pathetic art, but here's your mine portal. So you open this mountain up, and all of a sudden you're letting in oxygen. Let me try to stay away from oxygen. So you're letting in this oxygen. You get all of this water that starts to seep in to there as well. And essentially, the mine is now starting to breathe. And there's not organic matter in there. Instead, what there is there's a whole series of compounds called sulfides. And sulfides are very, very insoluble. There's mercury sulfide, there's iron sulfide. Sulfides are kind of one of the primary ore veins that you find. It's a place where minerals are concentrated. And so if you find sulfide deposits, you're likely going to find things that are appropriate for mining. The problem is that when you start to make these sulfides breathe, like let's just take an iron sulfide and you add in oxygen and you add in water, just like you get carbon dioxide or carbonic acid from when we breathe, when you make that mine breathe, you start to form sulfuric acid. And there's another kind of reaction that happens in there as well. Iron has different charges on it. If you take iron and have it in the +2 charge and you add oxygen to it to make iron in the +3 charge, that also releases acids. And so those are a couple of the most common things that are released, the sulfuric acid and acid that are released when you oxidize iron. Yeah.
So that's when air gets into a mine tunnel. When the tunnel or the mines fill up with water, does mm-hmm. that change that? The chemical reactions that go on?
Well, it's the water plus the oxygen that kind of drives it. So the oxygen all by itself doesn't do anything. It's when you add the two together. So as long as the water is oxygenated there, you'll start to get these reactions. And so the problem with the mine here is that, you know, they've taken out certain amounts of ore here, but, I mean, look at Copper Mountain and how big it is. That's got huge amounts of sulfides in it, and those sulfides are just going to keep oxidizing and oxidizing and oxidizing, and once you've opened this mine up and you let that air and that water in there, it'll just keep going and going and going until all this stuff is used up. And so that's one of the reasons why mines are a legacy issue. Because of all these sulfides, endless supply of sulfides. So that's one of the issues that's facing the Holden mine here, is that, you know, there, when you go up and look at the portal where the water is draining out there, you can see that there's white stuff coming out of it. It looks discolored. If you measure the pH on that, it's acidic. Because of this acid mine drainage, that's going to go on for a long, long time. I know that the estimates here have been like it's going to take like 200 years or so is what they're estimating for all of this stuff to get used up. I think that's highly optimistic in terms of how long it's going to take for things. I think that must be some sort of a threshold at which it starts to taper off, because it gets a little bit harder and harder. You can imagine here that initially you're oxidizing, all of the things sort of near the mine shafts there, but when you get the stuff at the surface, it's going to be harder and harder to get into the stuff behind. And so that's, I guess, probably what the 200 years refers to. But that's the essential problem with any of these mines here, is that once you open them up to oxygen and water, you can't shut them back up again. They're just going to go. It's a little reactor system that's just going to keep going and going and going and going. And so that's one of the aspects of this mine cleanup here that's going to happen, is that they actually have to put a water treatment facility in place up on the tailings somewhere to capture all of this drainage that's coming out of the mine and actually treat it. And they'll have to, that has to be in place for 200 years, 300 years, 400 years, however long it takes before this stuff starts to taper off to the point that they don't think that it's needed anymore. But essentially, it's like a little city. It's generating its own waste. It has to be treated indefinitely. And so that's one of the problems that you run into with these mines when you crack them open. Any questions? Okay. So contaminants, the kind of contaminants that you get in these things then are all sorts of metals. The ones that they worry about here at the Holden Mine are things like copper, zinc, iron, aluminum. I think manganese is another one that they're paying attention to. They've looked for mercury. There doesn't seem to be a whole lot of mercury in here, but in general you can get mercury. You can get lead. I don't know, I'm sure I'm forgetting some of these. Cadmium is another one that gets commonly measured. Cadmium. The problem is, when you get all this acid mine drainage in there, the acid starts to dissolve these metals. So if the water was neutral, if you didn't have the acid there, you probably wouldn't have a big problem with these. But the acid releases all these metals. And so you get all these metals that you have to worry about in terms of contaminants. And if any of you were in my session, I guess it was on Monday, the top five of the There's 71,000 water bodies in the United States that are listed as impaired right now, and the number two cause of those impairments is metals, other than mercury. If you add mercury in with that, then metals plus mercury is the top impairment of all these 71,000 waters in the country. So metals are a big deal, and acid mine drainage is one of the ways that you pick these things up. Another thing that's unique to, or well, not necessarily unique, but it comes into play with the Holden Mine here, is cyanide. For a while, cyanide was being used in one of the ways of trying to concentrate the ore before they shipped it off down the water. And so some of these tailings, I think before the 1940s, are laced with lots of cyanide. So that's another issue that the Holden Mine tailings have to deal with. So impacts. Well, there's several different impacts here. Obviously, there's degraded water quality is the one that I'm focused on here. And so you can think about drinking water. We get water out of Railroad Creek, presumably above where the mine drainage is happening. But downstream, this flows into Lake Chelan, and anything, you know, like Lucerne probably gets their water from nearby there as well. So you have to worry about things for drinking water. You have to worry about it for swimming. I've heard anecdotes from people who are here in at Holden, and they won't let their kids swim anywhere near the water below the tailings. This is just based on superstition. I mean, the thing about water that's kind of scary is that for the most part you can't see it when it's bad. You know, we're very visual in how we relate to things. You know, you see a bear. That's a threat. You run, you take measures. You see an avalanche, you know, you get out of the way. When you see water, clear water, you look at it, you have no idea. You don't know if it's contaminated with bacteria. You don't know if it's contaminated with organic compounds. You just don't know. And of course, we have a very special relationship to water. I mean, water is actually more important than food for us in order to be able to survive. So there's a very emotional tug at us with anything that comes to water. And so, you know, I can completely relate to this idea about not letting my kids swim below the tailings, because you don't know what the impacts are going to be. You can't see it. And we want to be able to see it. We want things to be obvious. And so when it comes to water, there's a very emotional reactions to it, whether it's tap water versus bottled water, whether it's swimming in a stream. I mean, you know, we like to think that we can come to the mountains and see this crystal clear water, and we know that it has to be better than what we're getting out of the tap back home. Well, that may be true as long as there's not Giardia floating around in there. But, you know, so it's a very emotional response to it. So, you know, that's what everybody's worried about here is what's the impact of this mine on the drinking water? What's the impact on swimming? What about fishing? What about ecology? Another particular impact that I have here, the hole in mine there, is something called cementation. When iron oxidizes, I guess it's off my board here, when iron oxidizes, iron 2 is very, very soluble. Iron 3 is hardly soluble at all. So as soon as you convert this stuff into iron 3, all of a sudden you get all sorts of precipitates that fall out. And basically what happens in Railroad Creek below the tailings is that it starts cementing all the rocks together, cementing all the sand together. It's something, I guess the terminology for it is not concrete, but ferricrete. And when that happens, then it impacts all of the biology, all the benthic organisms that can do anything within the sediments there. If it's concrete, they can't live there, because benthic organisms need to be able to come and get in and out and scurry around and take food in. So that's one of the particular impacts that happens in the Holden Mine here as well. So this is the study that I kind of did, that I was describing to you earlier. There's the Holden Mine. So the way they do these kinds of studies here is they want to take water from important places. So P5 refers to the water that's coming out of the mine shaft itself. This is coming straight out of the mine. CC1 is Copper Creek. RC1 is Railroad Creek above the mine. So this is something that you want to use as a background. So the question here is, how is this mine impacting the water in Railroad Creek? And so one of the ways you do it is you take water above the mine, and then you take water below the mine and just see what's different about the two of them. There's another one on here too, tailings leachates, which I guess doesn't show up on this particular map here. Then you also want to see, you know, this is directly below the tailings here. You also want to see how far downstream this stuff travels. So this is near milepost 7, near 7 Mile Creek. And then also you want to see what's happening in Lake Chelan. So the Railroad Creek 3 sample, the RC3, is all the way at the mouth of Railroad Creek. Railroad Creek provides about 12% of the water into Lake Chelan. So it's not a huge amount, I guess, but it's an eighth of the water into Lake Chelan comes from Railroad Creek. So you also want to be able to measure the impact of this all the way on down. So the leachate here, I guess it's got a little arrow there, and that's pointing right about there, so it must be coming somewhere near Railroad Creek. So that's where they study the measurements here. And if you get bored with lots of numbers and tables, let me know and we can move quickly or move on past these things, but I just wanted to give you an example of how this looks. So let's just take a look at this top line here, iron. So at the drainage, we've got 591 parts per billion is what that is. Micrograms per liter and parts per billion are the same thing. And almost 40,000 in this leachate. If you look at what happens at Railroad Creek above the mine, it's at 71. Copper Creek is 32. Railroad Creek, right below the tailings, it's 599. So that shows you, that demonstrates that clearly you're having an impact on the mine. You've increased it, or on the water. You've increased it from 71 on up to nearly 600 because of this drainage that's coming in from the mine. And so you can play that same game with all of these things. So aluminum is not quite so bad. It's gone from 13 to 44. Manganese from 1.3 to 8.2. Zinc, factor of 10, 3.7 to 36. Copper, factor of 10, 1.4 to 14. So that kind of gives you a rough idea about the impact on the metals, how we're adding metals into this water. And then, of course, one of the bigger questions, too, then, is what actually gets out all the way to Lake Chelan. And you can see that most of these things drop off a bit in transit. And there's various processes that can take metals out, precipitation. Can take them out. That's probably one of the main ones. So that kind of gives you an idea about what the impact is of these metals on Railroad Creek. This is kind of an interesting one here too that I thought you might like to see. So this is based on these concentrations and how much water is flowing by. You can calculate how many pounds of contaminants are being released per day. from the mine. And so that's what this table here is. It shows a number of pounds per day that's being released by the mine. So in this case, for instance, you've got 1,159 pounds of iron every day that's being drained into, coming from the mine, from the tailings or the mine itself, that are being drained into Railroad Creek. You've got 76 pounds of aluminum, 15 pounds of manganese, 70 pounds of zinc, 28 pounds of copper, cadmium, lead are kind of a little bit trace. And this is, you know, you can combine this to the portal and kind of get an idea about how important the mine drainage itself is versus the tailings. So you can see from the mine portal itself that almost all, or you know, two-thirds of the aluminum could be coming straight out of the portal, whereas for iron, almost none of the iron is coming out of the portal. So this kind of gives you an idea about the relative impacts of the tailings themselves versus the portal, the acid mine drainage that's coming out of the portal. And you can kind of see some of the relative numbers on all of these as well. So, you know, 1,000 pounds of iron, I think, is reasonably impressive. So one of the questions, I mean, these are all just numbers and concentrations and pounds and what we really want to know, since we can't see this stuff, we want to know, is it toxic to us? Is it toxic to the wildlife? Is it toxic to, you know, what is the implications of these different concentrations? So this is a figure of the iron that was measured in Railroad Creek. There's a couple of different levels here. So the EPA has got a level set at 1,000 for drinking water purposes. And this is just strictly due to aesthetics. It actually isn't a health threat. The iron in the water is not a health threat. They just figure you don't want to look at orange water. And so it's not a health threat. It's just an aesthetics threat. The Canadians set theirs a little bit lower, around 300, and you can kind of get an idea. So above the mine, the iron concentrations in, I guess these are, what is this? June is in the boxes. September is in the circles there. They wanted to get an idea about low flow versus high flow in the stream, just to see what the difference is. So you can see that all of these samples that are taken below the mine here are above this Canadian criteria. Some of them are above the EPA, but not all of them. So, but there's clearly an elevated amount of iron in these things, and it's kind of bordering on what the EPA and certainly Canada would consider acceptable. This one here is a little bit different here. What they've done is, on this axis here, it's the percent of the water quality criteria. So if it's at 100%, that means it's right at that level of what's considered okay. If that's at 200%, that means it's double, 300% is triple, 400% is quadruple. So this particular plot here has got three different kind of metals on it. So that high square one up there is copper. And so what that tells you is that right below the tailings, the copper is nearly four times the acceptable level in terms of water quality standards. When you get down to the mouth, it's only at about 170%, so it's not quite two times the amount. So everything sort of decreases here. Zinc up at the just below the tailings is about double. When you get down to the mouth here, it's below the water quality standard. Cadmium is about 125%. When you get down to the mouth, it's dropped below.
Question.
Yeah.
Do you know if the standards are set based on drinking water or ecological damage?
These are ecological standards. So these are this is based on acute and chronic toxicity to organisms. The drinking water standards, they didn't list these in the report, but my understanding is that all of these are below the drinking water standards. In other words, the ecology is much more sensitive to these things than human beings are. So let's see, what was the last one? Figure 9, September versus June. Okay, that's the difference. So these are two separate plots instead of one combined plot. So I guess I was already in the June one, right? So there's the separate. So the June is the high flow, the September one is the low flow. And you can see during the low flow times, there's actually, it doesn't appear to be such a big deal. And I would guess that part of this has to do with spring runoff, flushing a lot more material into the creek. And that's a pretty common phenomenon. This kind of gives you an idea about what the iron has been doing at various times. So this is a series of 3 years of sampling, and it shows you what the iron tracks at. Again, there's the Canadian threshold at 300 parts per billion. Here's the EPA threshold at 1,000 parts per billion, and this kind of gives you an idea about about how the iron varies over time from year to year, month to month, as you go across these 3 years. Most of the time, this one here, this particular value here, I think has been pretty much discounted as erroneous. So for the most part, the iron concentration always seems to be above this Canadian threshold anyway. This is a measure of the zinc. Zinc has kind of got some interesting, and I don't completely understand the relationship, or I haven't studied the relationships between zinc, but there's a couple of different markers here that, you know, depending on the hardness of the water, there's different thresholds. So this line here is when there's 10 milligrams per liter of hardness. This line here is at 22 milligrams per liter of hardness. Apparently, when the water is harder, you can get away with more zinc in the water and still have it be safe. And so that kind of gives you an idea over the same 3 year time period about how the zinc varies below the tailings. And you know, there's some pretty high values in there. There's actually several values that are below these thresholds as well. And then another way of doing these tests on here is, you know, it's one thing to measure concentrations and make decisions on it or try to get an idea of the water quality. Another thing that you can do is you actually can just incubate things in there and see what happens. The survival test means, did this stuff kill it off? Is it, by having these organisms live in this water, this is the Ceriodaphnia, which I think is some sort of a small little zooplankton critter. So at any of these concentrations above, below the tailings, at the mouth, none of these things died because they were in the water. And so the acute toxicity of these critters doesn't seem to be an issue. On the other hand, the chronic effects, and reproduction is considered one of the chronic effects in water quality. The chronic effects did take a hit. What this refers to is that when the water is diluted all the way down to 6.25%, you could still see reproductive effects. In other words, the reproduction of this organism was inhibited, was impacted even by concentrating this water diluting this water by a factor of 16. In this case, a factor of 8, that case a factor of 4. So there's not acute effects of this water on these organisms, but there are chronic effects on these organisms. This is jumping into the sediments. Another issue is there's a very thriving benthic ecology in most sediments and streams, a lot of things going on in them as well. And so they wanted to measure what the values of these things in the sediments as well. So I guess I'll just point you toward some. So the concentrations of some of these metals here in the tailings piles are pretty high. Railroad Creek iron, 15,700 in the sediments above, 19,000 in the sediments below, 26,000 at this milepost 7. So what's your interpretation of that, just out of curiosity?
It makes it with oxygen.
Why is it going up instead of down in the sediments?
Precipitation.
Well, it could be precipitation, or it's just sort of a hydrodynamic, it's a sort of a sorting thing there where you carry this water down there and then at some point it drops out, it sediments out. So this, for whatever reason, the area around milepost 7 seems to have a collection place for sediment. It could be that the creek slows down there. It might be a more calm spot where everything flattens out a little bit and things start to deposit, but it's kind of the interesting dynamic between sediments and the water. The water just kind of flows through the system, but the sediments park in various places on the bed until there's some sort of a flooding event, and they get picked up and carried along, and then they get dropped. And so there's this interesting kind of spiraling and concentration that happens with sediments that doesn't happen with the water itself. But anyway, so at the mouth, 14,800. I mean, most of these values at the mouth are not a whole lot different than the values that were measured up above the mine here. So it doesn't seem like there's a huge impact on it doesn't seem like there's a huge impact on the metals. I think one of the more critical pieces of information that they latched onto is the fact that the zinc was more than double at the mouth compared to what it was above there, and I know that that was an issue of concern for these, for the ecologists. And then this is just another species here. So when you do these kinds of incubations, you know, you don't want to hinge everything on just one species. And so typically, the typical thing is to take three different species. There's a couple of them here that were done in here. And so this is, gives an example of another species that was incubated in these waters. And this is the percent of survival. And so 65% survived in the waters, or sorry, in the sediments above Railroad Creek, 93% below, 91%, 63% down at the mouth. So from this particular assay here, you'd have to say that there really was no effect of the sediments above and below the tailings, or, you know, from these contaminants that are coming in. And then finally, I think this is the last one that I have from the actual report here that shows you the density of invertebrates. So the number per square meter. So above the mine, you've got over 3,000 of these invertebrates per square meter. You get down below the mines, it drops to 50. And this is a result of that concrete, that ferricrete stuff, the fact that you get all this precipitate out there that, that sort of gloms everything together and turns it into a hard mess that nothing can sort of thrive in. And you can still, even down at miles post 7, there still seems to be some impact of that. At the mouth, there apparently still seems to be some impact of that as well. That you know, that you just don't have nearly the diversity of species or the number of species that you do have up the mine. So there seems to be an impact there. So, you know, my take home on this report here is that there really is very little threat to human health from what's coming out of the mine right now. I don't think it's, you know, I think would I send my kids to swim in the water below the tailings? You know, I wouldn't like say go there, but if they did go there, I wouldn't chase them away either. I think that for the most part, all of the impacts here are the primary impacts from this water, from the mine here, is all related to ecology, to the benthic ecology, to the water ecology, the organisms that are floating around in the water here. So this mine cleanup really is about taking care of the environment, and in some ways, not so much about taking care of the humans, which, you know, in some ways, you could say that that's a good thing. You know, that it's important for us to be able to take care of the environment as well, and not just be focused always on humans and be anthropocentric in our view. I think, you know, as stewards of God's creation, we clearly need to take a holistic perspective and look at everything and take care of the whole thing, all of it, not just how it impacts humans. You know, that said, there's still some interesting, I guess, ethical questions about this mine and this cleanup, and why now, and is it worth the cost, and is it worth the risks, and many other things. And I think that John Jensen has a session where I think he's going to get more into that side of the situation. If you had a chance to go to the discussion of the mine cleanup, I think on Mondays they're usually having a question and answer session as well with the directors here and somebody from, I think it's the Forest Service or somebody who's in charge of the cleanup, and so you can get some more answers about that. So there's a few different opportunities here to get some information about what's going on and have some questions answered. Any questions about this stuff? Anything you wish that I'd shown that I haven't? Yeah.
Okay, so all of the metals,
mm-hmm.
Are they valuable? I mean, what if there was a paradigm shift that, okay, so you've got water with all these in it. Wow, maybe we can extract it and it becomes a valuable commodity.
Well, I mean, most of these metals here, and certainly the metals.
Or is it such a low dilution that it's not, I mean, it's not worth extracting from the water? Do you kind of get a sense of what I'm saying?
I mean, there's been many different plans. There's been many different suggestions for how to deal with this. One of them was to actually remine the tailings, because there was a pretty inefficient process for getting some of the gold and silver out the first time around. And there's still many, many millions of dollars of gold and silver in those tailings. And so one of the ideas that was tossed around for a while was actually to remine them and then put everything back in the mountain as you were mining it. That was one that was sort of kicked around for a while. I don't know why exactly that one was tossed aside as being unworkable. Do you have some thoughts on that?
Well, I was at the Q&A session on Monday, and somebody asked about remining the tailings, and they basically said the concentrations were too low to make it economically viable. I mean, they actually said that they did a pretty good job of mining them the first time around.
Okay. Yeah. And as far as some of these other metals, I mean, I guess, you know, even though we are running through resources at a high rate on this planet, I guess we're still not quite desperate enough to go after those low concentrations at this point. You know, who knows where we're going to be in 100 years.
And that was kind of just before I came down here, I was reading that little book in our room about the history that was written in 87 of the place here. And in there, they were talking about that remining the gold that's in there. Uh-huh. And at that time, they said if somebody had said in a study that if gold got to $380 an ounce, it would be worth remining it. Look where it is now, they're still not going to do it. But that was really a low number. Look at how it's changed over the years.
Yeah, but I suppose that inflation. So what was what would that $380 then translate to right now in real dollars?
But it was just,
I don't have enough spare change to buy gold these days, so what is gold going for right now?
$1,300
or something.
Yeah, it's $1,500. $1,500, yeah. That's what I was thinking. I thought of $1,400,
$1,500, and this was back there. Yeah. 87. Huh. But the other problem with stuffing them back in the mine is the mine's filled to the third level with water.
Yeah, well, I mean, presumably you'd be flushing water back out again is what you'd end up doing, which would cause some of its own problem, I'm sure. Any other questions? Yeah.
So the creek looks orange because of the iron.
Right.
What makes it look white as it directly comes out of the mountain?
I guess that's aluminum. That's an aluminum that's precipitate. Aluminum. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's also probably the limestone that they...
Yeah, I understand. I know that they lined it with limestone, but I understand that it's all pretty much from aluminum hydroxides. Any other questions about the Holden stuff? Yeah.
There was one slide that showed the percent of organisms surviving above and below the tailings, and it looked like, I think, above the tailings it was like 65%, and below it was like 93%. Mm-hmm. Do you have any idea why it actually got better after the pollution?
So these are sediment samples. I really don't understand. I mean, I guess the only thing is, you know, I don't know enough about this particular species. And all I can suggest is that it must be very metal happy. Everything will have different things that it thrives in. And for whatever reason, this one must do well with lots of metals around. So. That's my guess, but I'm not a biologist, so I can't really give you a great answer.
Are they doing other studies with other species to...
Let me see, did I whack? No, I don't even have that on this computer anymore. There was some other kind of thing called microtox or microtox screen study that I didn't really understand, and so I'm hesitant to put stuff on here that I can at least partially explain. So I left it off. Yeah.
When I was at the session on Monday night, somebody, I think, made a statement that it wasn't all of Railroad Creek that was really affected. It was just a couple miles of it. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't seem to be consistent with this data that shows that the whole creek downstream is pretty much, you know, affected even to the mouth. Mm-hmm. But then I'm also thinking, I mean, is it fairly safe to say that the impacts in Lake Chelan would be trivial, if any? I mean, 12% is actually not, it's actually fairly significant, but it's only an eighth. So I would think this would all be diluted enough that...
Right. You know. Well, that seems to be the consensus, you know, dilution is the solution to pollution kind of thing. And so apparently by the time it gets out there, it's just not enough to really be concerned about. That seems to be a consensus. Mm-hmm. You know, and they've done fish studies as well. So they, you know, there's a whole phenomenon with metals too, of bioaccumulation, biomagnification. And that's where, you know, where certain kinds of metals get concentrated as you go up the food chain. They're at low concentrations in the water, so the first thing that takes them in will get some concentrated in their tissues. Whatever eats that, things will get them more concentrated in their tissues. And so they've done these kind of bioassays with rainbow trout and they find virtually, you know, things like arsenic. I forget what they're, you know, for some of these metals, they're either below the detection limit, and they can't even measure them at all, or they're, you know, well below the any kind of what do they call that, biological criteria, eating criteria kind of thing. I mean, they're not a safety hazard for eating purposes too. So that's yet another indicator of what's happening with these metals in there, is that it doesn't seem to be bioaccumulating to any significant extent in the fish that are swimming around them.
Are there fish in Lower Railroad Creek?
It's either that, or it was once that they found nearby the mouth. I don't remember where, but you know, I don't know the answer to that.
I'm wondering if there's an impact. Well, if there would naturally be fish, and if not,
yeah. You know, yep. Have you fished below Lower Railroad Creek?
I'm wondering if there's any way to compare the pollution in Railroad Creek to the pollution found in other rivers, or like around the country, for instance. I'm just curious, like the level of pollution relative to other areas.
They actually do compare them to other creeks and rivers right around Washington State, just to kind of get an idea of background. And so even though arsenic is sort of high on the in terms of water quality criteria for Railroad Creek, it's not elevated because of the mine. It seems to be just background levels that you find in like the river flowing down and from Stehekin, any of the rivers. It just seems to be a natural part of the deposits around here that arsenic is. So yeah, they do those kind of comparisons, and Railroad Creek for the most part doesn't really jump out as being that much different than any of the others, other than, you know, what I've shown here with some of these metals that are pretty obvious.
Yeah, in the session right before lunch too, he made that same statement that we made, that it's only a few miles in here that it seems to be a problem. Once you get downstream, that's what they say. They're not concerned, you know, about the water flowing into Lake Huron or anything.
Yeah,
it dilutes itself enough in the.
And a lot of that impact in that first mile or two is just from this precipitation and this ferry creek that gets formed. Well, I've got a few minutes here. Just let me jump just a little bit into a different mine system, just because. This is one of California's legacies. All these little silver droplets here in the Coast Range, this is mercury mines that sprang up in the late 1800s. All of these little gold nuggets things all over here in the Sierra are where the gold mines sprung up during the gold rush. This is Sacramento. This is where we live, right around here, Davis, California. And so there's this kind of interesting phenomenon in these mines. I mean, you know, there's all sorts of issues that came up with these gold mines. You know, the hydraulic mining. I don't know if you've heard about hydraulic mining before, but it was where they would literally take high-powered jets of water and literally just blast away entire hillsides, mountainsides, and run that sediment through sluice boxes and to get out the gold. And it literally coated the central valley and, you know, like maybe tens of feet of sediment. It just buried the whole upper end of the valley in sediment when they did this hydraulic mining stuff. I mean, it's just amazing the kinds of things that are get done to pull stuff out. Anyway, one of the things that was kind of interesting about this is that these mercury mines, they would mine the mercury in here, and then they would cart it over here, because you can use mercury as a way of extracting gold out of rock as well. It dissolves the gold, and so you dissolve the gold out of the rock with the mercury there, and then you boil off the mercury in order to get the gold back. And you try to reclaim the mercury if you can, but not all of it gets reclaimed, because back in the 1800s there, they weren't terribly efficient on getting this stuff back. But anyway, so this mercury, over the years, they mined about 115,000 tons of mercury from all those mines back in the heyday. Because of this, and just from the placer mining alone up in here, they lost about over 4,000 tons of mercury that just disappeared because of you know, the inefficiencies of what they were doing, because of slopping it and spilling it. So you literally, when you get up to near the mine shafts here, you can actually find beads of mercury in the streams, and just floating around in the rocks there. It's pretty bad. You know, we've got definitely have a lot of criteria, fish criteria there, where the amount of mercury in the fish makes it pretty unsafe. So there's mercury all over in the rivers. There's mercury near the mines. The mercury washes down the river and ends up in the delta here, the estuary. It ends up in the wetlands. wetlands are a particularly bad spot for it because the mercury in the wetlands, when it goes anoxic, it converts the mercury, just the elemental mercury, into something called methylmercury. And methylmercury is so toxic that just the tiniest little drop hitting your skin will go into your blood system and kill you. There was a researcher that, you know, got a pinprick in their glove. Actually, I think it went through their glove and into them and killed them. So it's a very, very toxic form of mercury. Mercury is nasty because all forms of mercury are toxic, whether it's in its elemental form, liquid, elemental form as a gas, whether it's a salt like mercuric chloride, whether it's a methylmercury, organic mercury, all the forms are toxic, but the methylmercury is the worst, and that's one of the things that we're having to deal with now, is all these wetlands all the way here, all the way up and down the valley, they've got too much mercury in them and they've got too much methylmercury, and so you can't hardly do anything. So, you know, we would love to be able to go and do a lot of wetland remediation in these estuaries because there's a lot of benefits to having wetlands. But it's a trade-off because as soon as you put in a wetland, you get mercury in there, you start creating this methylmercury. So it really kind of impacts California ecology, California water quality in so many different ways. And it's you know, let's see, I had a few talking points about that. Oh, just some other things. So over 4,000 tons of this stuff is lost. It would only take 330 tons in Lake Tahoe to get it all the way up to the maximum contamination level, which would make it undrinkable. You know, so this is just kind of gives you an idea. So what is that, 12 times as much as it would take for Lake Tahoe is what's been lost. Just another issue about this. So mercury really is kind of mercury mine is one of those legacy issues that we have to deal with. It's a little bit different type of concern than acid mine drainage, but it's certainly another impact thing for the state of California in terms of how prevalent it is in all the water ecosystems. So finally, I just want to leave you with this thought here. So again, I talked about Art Link. He was the grandfather of my best friend. He was the governor of North Dakota back when they first discovered all these, or first wanted to come in and start to strip down these different layers of coal that they found, lignite coal all over. And of course, everybody in the state was really excited about getting this in business and getting people to come in there and all the money it would generate, all the tax money, all of the economic impact that it would have. And he was one of the sane voices in the place and kind of put his foot down in terms of what he was willing to put up with and what he was not willing to put up with. And so this has kind of been called his Gettysburg Address. And I'll let you read it for yourself. I get a little bit emotional thinking about it just because I'm from the state. So I'll just let you read that to yourself. And I guess I'm done with what I have to say. And you can go on your way as you want. My daughter is planted a flapper.
Leave it better than it was before.
And so literally, apparently, when they skim the dirt off of a farmer's land, they have to keep track of which farm that came from, and they have to keep it marked. And when they get the coal out, they have to go back and they have to take the dirt that came off that farmer's land and bring it back and put it back in place. That's literally how thorough the vision was put in place for this, and it's kind of become a model for many other states to follow in terms of how they allow companies to come in and exploit their resources. Mm-hmm. So. Mm-hmm.